George Blake kept his composure for 3 whole days. He endured intense interrogation from the men who were once his colleagues and friends. As the hours passed, the lead interrogator, Harold Shergold, produced document after document asking George to explain how they had gotten into Russian hands. George said that he had no idea. Could he explain why he was the one common factor, the one person who'd had access to all of these files? Again, George shook his head. No clue, he claimed. Finally, Shergold gave George an out. Perhaps he was in debt or under threat of blackmail. That would be a perfectly understandable lapse in judgment. That crossed the line. George didn't mind being accused of being a spy. He didn't mind being called a traitor. But he was no cowardly patsy for the Russians. He banged the table and declared the truth. There was no blackmail. He had approached the Soviets. He had offered to spy for them entirely of his own free will. And he was proud of it. This is Espionage, the Parcast original, exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love, so let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. This is our second episode on George Blake, a British intelligence agent who secretly became a communist during the Korean War. When he returned to England, he began spying for the Russians, photographing documents and giving up the names of British spies, even those who thought he was their friend. This week, we'll hear about George's trial and imprisonment, and how his greatest feat of daring came years after he was finally put behind bars. George didn't quite know what to expect when the British Secret Intelligence Service, or SIS, unexpectedly recalled him from Shemlon, Lebanon, where he was living. He had moved there, hoping he might leave his life of spying behind and settle down with his wife and children to a more peaceful existence. In 1961, when an old friend and former SIS colleague came to Lebanon and told him he was wanted back in England, George initially feared the worst. But his fears were allayed as he was assured by both his friend and a Soviet contact that this was simply a routine matter, nothing to worry about. But as he sat down across from his superiors at SIS headquarters, it was immediately clear that this was no simple dotting of I's and crossing of T's. Their questioning was pointed and intense, and it culminated at the end of the first day of his interrogation with a devastating accusation. They believed George was a spy for the KGB and had handed over sensitive documents in order to advance the Soviet cause. That night, George returned to his mother's home, where he was staying while in England. He had denied the allegation, of course, but it was entirely true. And as he sat at dinner with his unsuspecting mother, he was forced to pretend that everything was fine. His mind reeled, but outwardly he discussed weekend and travel plans with characteristic good humor. Though he knew he was in trouble, George was still rationalizing. He thought he could talk his way out of this mess and get back onto good terms with his colleagues. The second day proceeded much as the first, with the noose tightening as the SIS interrogators provided further proof of George's treachery. And yet, George's denial continued. At lunch, he went to a nearby shop and had a mosquito net delivered to his wife in Lebanon, as if everything was just fine. He dined alone at a nearby restaurant, then returned for yet another round of interrogation. George's colleagues were generally polite and even friendly throughout the entire process. They were weaving a web, of course, making George feel like they were his old friends and that he could tell them anything. But the confession was all they really wanted. They presented him with document after document, nearly irrefutable evidence that he was a mole. But George managed to keep his cool, despite the fear roiling inside him. After lunch on the third day, they changed their tactics. Interrogator Harry Shergold threw George a lifeline. Shergold offered him a sympathetic motive for his obvious deceit, saying, quote, "We know you work for the Soviets. We understand why. You were blackmailed and had no choice but to collaborate with them." This is a classic interrogation technique across law enforcement branches. Former CIA interrogator Philip Houston says that it's almost like you're putting yourself in someone else's shoes and seeing it from their side. As Houston describes it, the interrogator begins by rationalizing the action, that is, offering a reasonable explanation for why the crime was committed, such as being coerced or blackmailed. Then they project blame by accusing someone else, like the Russians, of putting the suspect in that position. Throughout this, interrogators downplay the crime while emphasizing the importance of getting the truth out there, hopefully putting the suspect at ease and priming them to tell everything. Here, the technique worked, but not quite how Harry Shergold expected it to. George exploded at the interrogator, launching into an indignant rant. He was infuriated at the idea that he did what he did for any reason other than true conviction and ideology. Shergold's suggested version of events portrayed George as someone who could be cowed by blackmail. A sudden surge of pride swelled in George. He was proud of his convictions and of how he'd fought for them in his own treacherous way. Unable to contain these feelings, he fired back. "Nobody blackmailed me. I approached the Soviets and offered my services to them of my own accord." The interrogators were stunned. George had just confessed to everything, knowingly, eagerly. Rather than walk it back, he proceeded to lay out the entire story behind his conversion to communism and to the Soviet cause. They asked him to pause. If he was willing to share like this, then perhaps they could arrange more comfortable surroundings. The next day, a car picked up George at his mother's house and drove him to Shergold's cottage in the country. He was given a bedroom in the cottage, and over the course of three bizarre days, George Blake spoke with several SIS officers. He detailed the events of his life and the history of his deceptions. It was an oddly peaceful period. George would make pancakes in the mornings. At night, he would talk with his roommate, MI5 agent John Quine, about his fears, namely how his betrayal would affect his mother and especially his wife and children. At the end of the 3 days, George was formally arrested and taken to Brixton Prison to await trial. George's cottage roommate, John Quine, was dispatched to Shemlon, Lebanon almost immediately. There, he found George's wife, Jillian, and told her what George had confessed to. She had no idea what George was up to, and yet, in her own words, she had little trouble believing the news. Later, she would say, "I didn't think for a moment that they'd made a mistake." When she visited him in prison on May 2, 1961, she was pregnant with their third child. And yet, She couldn't bring herself to be angry with him. Sitting across from George, she didn't see a traitor to her country. She saw the man she loved. The trial was the next day, May 3rd, and as of yet, the newspapers had barely discussed the news. The British government, embarrassed by the scope of George's treason, had put a gag order on the trial proceedings, restricting what the press could learn and print about the trial. When George was brought into the courtroom, his case seemed cut and dry. He had confessed fully. All that remained was the sentencing. The Official Secrets Act, under which George had been charged, provided a maximum sentence of 14 years. Spy Klaus Fuchs had received the maximum sentence only a few years earlier, after he was found guilty of passing atomic secrets to the Soviets. George's attorney argued that his treason had been comparatively minor and was driven by belief rather than greed. Still, even with his impassioned plea for leniency, George was nervous about the sentence. Would he spend a decade or more in jail? The judge heard the arguments, then began his own address to the court. He explained that George's fault had not lain in subscribing to communism. That wasn't a crime in England. But he had remained in a position of vital importance within the government, knowing he disagreed with their views, and then worked to undermine them. George sighed to himself. The maximum sentence it would be then. The judge was showing no signs of sympathy toward him. But George was wrong. It wouldn't be the maximum. It would be three times that. Each of George's five charges under the Official Secrets Act covered a different period of his career. The judge decided to punish him separately for each charge. Three would be served concurrently, then two more consecutively. That came to 42 years. It was unprecedented. He was going to prison longer than the man who'd leaked the secrets of the bomb. George had effectively been handed a life sentence. If George wasn't front page news before, he certainly was now. He was immediately transferred to the Wormwood Scrubs prison in West London. Naturally, he was considered a major flight risk. British officials were concerned that he might continue to communicate with his former KGB overseers, or that they might send agents to free him. As such, he was closely monitored. At first, he was held in an especially secured wing of the prison. After a few months with no incidents, he was released into the general population of Wormwood Scrubs, but his every movement was tracked in a logbook. George proved himself to be an exemplary inmate. He began to hold book clubs and salons with the younger prisoners, even helping them to draft letters of appeal in their cases. He took correspondence classes in Arabic. He practiced yoga. He even became friendly with the guards, joking casually about his status as an escape risk. By all appearances, George Blake was ready to settle into a long, edifying life in prison, surrounded by books and friends. But contrary to outward appearance, George knew from his very first day at Wormwood Scrubs that he was going to escape. And in 1966, 5 years into his 42-year sentence, he would attempt a daring mission to do just that. Next, we'll hear how George Blake masterminded an incredible prison break. Now back to the story. In 1961, George Blake had been sentenced to 42 years at Wormwood Scrubs Prison after his former employer, the British Secret Intelligence Service, had uncovered proof of his treason. Once in prison, he had become a model inmate, furthering his own education and teaching others. George became something of a folk hero around Wormwood Scrubs. Despite his betrayal of British intelligence, many felt that his punishment had been too harsh, a retaliatory measure and not true justice. Among these sympathizers were a pair of young revolutionaries named Michael Randall and Pat Pottle, who had been arrested as the ringleaders of an anti-nuclear war protest at an Air Force base. They weren't fans of the Soviets. Randall had even demonstrated against them some years prior. But they saw in George a kindred spirit, and the three soon struck up a friendship. Pottle was nearing the end of his sentence, and thus would soon be in a position to aid in George's escape. One afternoon in May of 1962, he and George were doing menial labor, sewing together mailbags. George excused himself to the restroom. As the guard nodded his assent, George caught Pottle's eye and subtly gestured, "Follow me." In the bathroom, alone, George handed Pottle a half-eaten chocolate bar, then walked out. At lunch, Pottle found a safe moment to see what George had given him. Opening the chocolate bar, he discovered a note tucked under the wrapper with instructions to help George escape once Pottle had been released. The note read, "If you feel you can help me on your release, go to the Russian embassy, introduce yourself, and say, 'I bring you greetings from Louise.'" The note went on to lay out a plot in which, with help from the embassy, Pottle would arrange to have a rope ladder thrown over the wall from outside the prison. This would allow George to climb out and escape. Though Pottle was sympathetic to George, he started to get nervous now that he was faced with having to act on those sympathies. Pottle brought the message to his friend Randall. The two agreed that, however much they liked George, the planned escape mission was too dangerous and could threaten their own peace movement if their involvement was discovered. Randall and Pottle finished their sentences soon after and left Wormwood Scrubs. They had been George's two best chances at escape, and now the situation seemed hopeless. At the same time, he became ever more determined to break out, whatever the cost. He had nothing left to lose. His personal life was in shambles. Despite Jillian's loyalty throughout the trial and early prison days, she had grown distant from him in recent months and was considering divorce. But he couldn't escape without an accomplice on the outside. Enter Sean Burke. Sean Burke was a hot-headed narcissist who had landed at Wormwood Scrubs in 1961 after attempting to mail bomb a cop who had been spreading rumors about Burke's sexuality. Burke was mercurial, but he could also be fiercely loyal to those he liked. Burke and George were in the habit of taking walks together through the prison halls. One afternoon in September 1965, Sean met up with George at their usual walking spot and noticed that something was off with his friend. George's eyes were downcast, his face troubled. Burke asked his friend what was wrong. The two started walking, and George quietly began to share his thoughts. George prefaced everything he was about to say with a disclaimer. If Burke said no to this proposition, there would be no hard feelings. George had no money to offer him, though he thought that he might be able to write a book about his life someday and turn a profit. Then George got to his point. He had lost hope that the Russians would save him. If he was going to escape, it would be on his own, and he wanted Burke's help. He knew that Burke would go before the parole board soon and would likely be released. Once that happened, he would need him to plan the escape from the outside. After a long moment, George offered to let Burke think it over for a few days. Burke jumped in immediately and said, "I don't have to think it over. I have already made up my mind." Apprehensive, George asked what his decision was. Burke said, "I'm your man." And so their plan was launched into motion. A few weeks later, Sean Burke went before the parole board, who granted him hostel, a type of conditional release which would free Burke during the days and have him spend his nights at a halfway house. With Burke now free to travel around London, he could acquire the necessary supplies for a breakout. But they were going to need money. Burke approached George's family, namely his mother and his sister, who had remained supportive throughout his 5 years in prison. He hoped that they could finance the plan, but they turned him down. George's sister especially thought the plan sounded half-baked and likely to get them all arrested as accomplices. So Burke turned to two old friends, Michael Randall and Pat Pottle. They had been George's friends in prison even more than he had, and yet so far, they had done nothing to help him. They seemed to have been moved by Burke's argument because they agreed to help with the plan. The team was assembled. In addition to Randall, Pottle, and Burke, George also enlisted a few of his fellow prisoners to help in the escape. First, Burke secured an invitation to a theater performance put on by inmates of Wormwood Scrubs. Sitting in the audience, he nudged his seatmate, one of George's inside men, and slipped him a two-way radio. Later that evening, the inmate brought the radio to George. Now George and Burke could communicate, albeit with George's radio at the lowest volume setting, and only at night when everyone had gone to sleep. In the wee hours, they would continue to plan out the specifics of the escape. Next, Burke bought knitting needles, dozens of them. He and George had agreed on a rope ladder as the best means of escape, but were worried that wooden or rope rungs wouldn't support George's weight. The knitting needles would provide surprisingly stable footholds as he ascended the ladder. George's fellow inmate Phil Morris was key to their plan. In his fourth floor cell, he had broken the bar over his window, then taped it back in place to avoid suspicion. George now had a route out of the main building and, with the rope ladder, a path over the wall once he reached the prison courtyard. This speaks to the loyalty George seemed to inspire in people. Morris was willing to help at no apparent benefit to himself. Though these seem like relatively simple preparations, they had to be done under the utmost secrecy. It took an entire year to get all of the pieces into place. But now, on October 22, 1966, they were ready. At 5 p.m., George took a shower in the prison bathroom. He got dressed, then carefully made his way down the hallway outside his cell. There was a wrestling match on the TV in the common room. George hoped that the commotion of the fight would mask his escape. After a casual encounter with a prison officer, he continued on up toward the fourth floor of Wormwood Scrubs. Here, he slipped into the cell of his co-conspirator, Phil Morris. On the walkie, running a little late, was Sean Burke. He was sitting in his car outside the wall of the prison, a bouquet of flowers on his passenger seat. This not only hid his radio, but gave him cover if anyone approached. He was simply delivering flowers to a friend. With Burke in place, it was time to go. Just after 6 p.m., George Blake pulled out the metal bar of the cell window. An easy task, thanks to Phil Morris, whose plan to break the window's bar had gone undetected by the guards. Outside, rain poured down onto the prison building. It made the tiles slippery and treacherous as George slid through the narrow window and onto the roof. Gripping onto a gutter, George carefully lowered himself over the side of the roof, then dropped. He landed on the ground below, then pressed himself into a hollow in the prison wall where the passing guards couldn't see him. Here, he waited for word from Burke. But on the road outside the prison, Burke was dealing with his own issue. A patrolman had driven up to Wormwood Scrubs' exterior gate to lock up and had stopped to take an especially long look at Burke's car. Feeling the pressure, Burke had driven away and was now rushing to get around the block and return, hoping the patrol moved on. Luckily, he had. With their brief window finally open, Burke radioed George. At the same time, George could hear a commotion coming from inside the building. The wrestling match had finished ahead of schedule, and the prisoners were loudly chattering as they headed back to their cells. He was out of time. When Burke radioed, George told him to throw the ladder over right away. They couldn't wait a moment longer. Burke had been holding off as long as he could. The patrol had moved on, but now more cars were parking in the street around him as a nearby hospital's visiting hours began. He heard the urgency in George's voice and decided it was now or never. Jumping out of the driver's seat, he grabbed the rope ladder from the back of the car and threw it over the prison wall. George sprinted across the yard to the wall and made his way up the rope ladder as quickly as he could. But when he reached the top and looked down, George realized they hadn't secured the ladder properly. He could climb up it with Burke holding the other side tight, but coming down, there would be nothing to keep the whole thing from being pulled down all 20 feet of the wall's height. A solution as simple as nailing the bottom of the ladder to the inside of the wall would have solved the problem. He didn't have time to think or strategize, though. He was vulnerable, easily spotted at the top of the wall. So he jumped, and he fell. On impact, George broke his wrist and slammed his head against the asphalt of the street. Dazed, bleeding, and bruised, George stood up and, with Burke's help, tumbled into the back seat of the car. He was bloodied and battered by the escape, but George Blake, after 5 years, was finally free. Next, we'll hear how George found his way out of England and into the welcoming arms of an old ally. Now back to our story. In October 1966, George Blake finally escaped Wormwood Scrubs Prison, where he'd been held for 5 years of a 42-year sentence. The night of the escape, George and his co-conspirator, Sean Burke, went straight from the prison to a safe house, a private apartment that Burke had taken out under a false name a few weeks prior. Within the hour, guards discovered George missing and sounded the alarm up to the highest levels of the British government. As the manhunt ensued, George relied on his old activist friends Michael Randall and Pat Pottle, who helped shuttle him and Burke between various safe houses owned by secret supporters of George. They even managed to find a doctor who was willing to secretly patch up George's broken wrist using gauze stolen from a TV prop house. But still, the major problem hadn't been solved. George was free, but where could he possibly go? And how could he safely get there? Staying in England wasn't an option. Even if his mother and sister would take him in, he would still be a fugitive from justice. He briefly considered fleeing to Cairo, where he had spent time as a teenager, but eventually he settled on the most natural solution. He chose to return to the Soviets he had helped so much during his decade as a spy. And so he settled on East Berlin. But getting there wouldn't be easy. Air travel was off the table. George was recognizable nationwide thanks to his escape. He could disguise himself, but even then, nobody in the crew had the know-how or connections to forge papers that could help him maintain this identity. The crew briefly considered helping George enter the Soviet embassy by hoisting him over the wall, but George rejected the plan. He didn't want to be a bother to the Soviets, who would have to deal with an international incident if he was found at their embassy in England. He also feared being trapped inside the embassy for years on end, as previous defectors had sometimes been. The only viable option remaining was to bring him across the border by car. The crew acquired a camper van, which they modified by creating a small compartment under the bed behind a set of drawers. George could hide out there for the duration of their trip, which would take them across a ferry to the European mainland. There, they would pass numerous checkpoints and hope nobody inspected them too closely. Michael Randall, George's old friend from prison, was chosen as the driver. Randall decided to bring his family, his wife Anne and their two kids, hoping that they would just look like a family on vacation. Under cover of night, after nearly 2 months of hiding, George slipped into the secret compartment, and the Randall family began their long journey. Almost immediately, they encountered a problem. Barely an hour into the journey, as the Randall family neared the ferry at Dover, they heard a banging coming from the hidden compartment. They pulled to the side of the road and rushed into the back. On opening the secret compartment, they found George gasping for air. The hot water bottle they'd provided him with, to give him something to urinate into during the long journey, had generated a suffocating chemical smell. With George recovered and the bottle removed, they sealed him up again and continued forth. When they boarded the ferry, the Randalls had to go above deck and leave the RV parked in the hull in order not to arouse suspicions. But they encountered no problems here. A quick passport check and no customs search cleared the family without trouble. They had left Britain successfully. The ferry docked at Ostend, Belgium, and the Randall family drove into the city without issue. Once they'd passed beyond the Ostend city limits into a quieter part of the country, they pulled over once again to check on George. From here, they agreed, he could ride in the backseat with the kids. They were unlikely to face any further unexpected searches. The journey was uneventful until they reached the East German border. Expecting to deal with customs, the family had hidden George in his compartment once again. This was their last major test. If they could pass over the border, they would be home free until they reached East Berlin. But unlike in England, the customs officials here demanded to search the vehicle. George listened as the officials strolled about the RV, checking cabinets, moving from front to back. Finally, the footsteps had reached the bed, under which George's compartment was located. If the official checked the drawers, would he find George? George breathed a sigh of relief. The official had gone. Outside, the guards of the checkpoint cleared the Randall family, and they were soon on their way toward East Berlin. It had been nearly 30 hours of straight driving with no sleep, but the RV finally pulled to a slow stop a mile short of the East Berlin checkpoint. With affection, the Randall family bid goodbye to George, who thanked them profusely. Then he began to walk. George approached the barbed-wired walls and searchlights of the East Berlin checkpoint. Even though the view was intimidating, George himself was in high spirits. His confidence hadn't wavered, and he was sure the Russians would welcome him as an old ally. He hailed the checkpoint guard on duty and introduced himself. The story he told must have sounded unbelievable to the man, that he was the infamous spy George Blake and had made an incredible escape and journey across the continent and shown up here after months on the run at this guard's particular checkpoint. George was met, naturally, with some suspicion at this claim. He was placed in a small room at the checkpoint, where he waited for the Russians to figure out what to do with him. While he waited, calls were being placed up the chain of command, from one skeptical superior to the next, until a stroke of luck befell the wayward spy. A man by the name of Sergei Kondrashev happened to be in East Berlin for a conference that day. Kondrashev had been one of George's Soviet handlers during his years of spying. The chief of the KGB in Berlin had called Kondrashev in the middle of the night and asked him to check out this stranger claiming to be George Blake. George, for his part, spent the night in a bed at the station. At 8 a.m. the next morning, December 19, 1966, he was eating breakfast and taking his morning coffee when a familiar face entered the room. It was Kondrashev, who smiled brightly and hugged George tightly. He confirmed George's identity with the others and ushered him out of the station. George's plan had worked. the Soviets welcomed him just as eagerly as he'd hoped. His treason, his prison escape, and his defection to Russia all represented a major victory in the Cold War against the West, and they were thrilled to flaunt him as proof of communism's superiority. After a few weeks in hiding, to prevent any British attempts at extraction or worse, the Soviets moved him to Moscow. The decades following George's resettlement in the USSR saw him enter a period of uncharacteristic calm. Though his wife, Jillian, did eventually divorce him, George managed to maintain a cordial relationship, mostly for the sake of his children. All of them have visited George in Moscow. Over the decades, George has given occasional interviews to the press, often supporting the Soviet government. He showed no remorse for his actions, not the treason, nor the prison escape, nor the defection. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and then Soviet Russia itself in 1991, George was forced to question everything he had done. Was the betrayal worth it, now that the Soviet Union he had served no longer existed? George concluded that Soviet communism as an experiment had failed, not because its values were wrong, but because people were fallible. And he stayed in Russia, applauding the new government for handling the transition with grace, as he saw it. He compared the collapse of the Soviet Union to the decline of French and British imperialism worldwide. While the West had turned to violence to maintain its power and had often failed, Russia had let its satellites go peacefully. This point would be proven wrong in the following years, however, as Russia clashed with former Soviet states like Chechnya, Georgia, and Crimea. That didn't seem to shake George's confidence in communism as an ideology. In 2010, he declared that, "One day I believe that the majority of governments will voluntarily choose the communist model." The Russia of 2019 is clearly not what George Blake hoped it would be when he spied for the Soviet Union, nor when he defected there in 1966. But even if he disapproves of their current politics, George has few options. Returning home is, by now, completely off the table. George's reputation in England is a mixed one. As an avowed and admitted spy, there's no denying that his actions hurt England and America's standing in the Cold War. The wiretap tunnel, which extended underground into East Berlin to eavesdrop on internal communications, should have been one of the great successes of Western spycraft and intelligence gathering. Instead, the West was humiliated to learn that George gave the Soviets the full story before construction even broke ground. But others, including George himself, insist that his punishment was inordinately harsh. To charge him for multiple violations of the Official Secrets Act was unheard of. The 42-year sentence made it seem like George's punishment was meant to make an example of him rather than serve the cause of justice. There's one place, however, that George's reputation suffers no ambiguity. At the age of 96, George Blake remains a hero in Russia. Under the Soviet Union, he was awarded the highest civilian honor, the Order of Lenin, as well as a military decoration, the Order of the Red Banner. And in 2007, Russian President Vladimir Putin bestowed the Order of Friendship onto George Blake. Through the fall of the Soviet Union and through the rise of modern-day Russia, he has been a consistent point of pride for the Russian government. George believed in what he did. Unlike many spies, there was no money and no fear driving his actions, just a true devotion to the communist cause. It's a valuable reminder that in the war of intelligence, one country's traitor is another's hero. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. For more information on George Blake, amongst the many sources we used, we found Roger Hermiston's book, The Greatest Traitor, extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Espionage is written by Thomas Dolan Gavitt. I'm Carter Roy.